The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 126.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi guys, welcome to today's live stream. I'm right here in St. Bart's. I'm actually at my Airbnb today. I'm not over at Hugh's place like I was last weekend. So I know Hugh's family is, they're traveling quite a bit. And so I'm sure Hugh's busy. I didn't want to bother him this weekend. But it'll be just me solo right here in St. Bart's. I've got to work on my posture today, guys, because you know what's funny is I went cliff diving, actually, with a gentleman that I met here who's, I won't go into his name, but he's a hedge fund guy you guys would recognize from CNBC and stuff like that. But anyway, the guy's like, 10 years older than I am. He's probably 57 years old. And it's about a 45-minute swim out to this these cliffs where you dive out at this place called Shell Beach. And I think if you guys are following Casey, you probably don't follow Casey Neistat, but if you know who he is, the vlogger, he did a vlog there. But he jumped off the wrong cliffs. They're way on the other side. But anyway, my point is I've considered myself a decent swimmer, but nothing great. And when I swam out in the ocean, you know, over this 45 minutes, I realized that my ocean swimming is terrible. I'm not very good. I can only go maybe 10 minutes straight without having, you know, without having to stop and just take a breather and float there on my back for a while. So anyway, my point, the reason my back is sore today is because yesterday I was out practicing all day. And today after the live streams, I'm going to do the same thing. I was actually watching YouTube videos on like how to properly do it. I didn't know there was so much form to swimming. You know, you got to have your high elbow and then go in and kind of do this and a pull. So I'm going to be working on that today. Anyway, let's see. Oh, one thing I wanted to tell everyone, if you're thinking about or if you've thought about checking out Rebel Capitalist Pro, now's a great time to do it. I just spoke with Gene, who's my digital marketing guy, and he did this promo where if you go to GeorgeGammon.com/pro, you can try out Rebel Capitalist Pro for like $1 for a week. So it's a super great deal. It's that online investment forum I have with research from Lynn Alden, Chris McIntosh. We do member Q&As with Lynn and Chris. It's awesome. If you want to build wealth and thrive in a world of out of control central banks and big governments, you definitely got to check it out. Again, it's George Gammon, GeorgeGammon.com/pro. Okay, let's get right into the questions. That's why everyone is here. Question number one from AV, passive investing bubble. In the event causing a wave of outflows, what stops the Fed from colluding with fund managers and force them to offset those repo levers? Well, I don't know if they'd have to force the managers to do anything, because in that type of scenario, the managers wouldn't have enough capital. They wouldn't have the assets to counterbalance the net selling from the passive investment funds, because they have so much of the assets under management. You've really got to think that through. I know I got a lot of comments on that video. The video is super popular. If you haven't seen it, it's the last whiteboard video I did, but I believe it is. And it's about the stock market going to zero. It sounds like clickbait, but it's actually not. If you watch the video and all the way to step number three, there's some quite a bit of study from Mike Green, as you mentioned, about this. And I'm actually going to be interviewing Mike the beginning of September. So definitely check that out on the Rebel Capitalist Show. It's something I'm really, really looking forward to. But I do think that there's something to be said for the Fed coming in and just putting in that bid, because the way the market gets to zero is if there's just no bid from active managers or from retail, because there's so much of the assets in passive. And if they have net outflows, then there's just, I use the simple example of saying if there's $1,000 of outflows in passive on net balance, That's what most people, they say, well, there'd always be buying and there'd always be selling. Yeah, that's right. There's always buying on passive maybe, but I'm talking about just net and an aggregate total. If you have $1,000 worth of outflows and there was only $500 on the retail side or under active management, there's no bid. How do you get the $1,000 that you need if there's only 500 that can buy? The math just doesn't work. So, but to your point, I think the Fed could come in and print bank reserves. Then the question is, how do they buy with those bank reserves? I don't know. I mean, you've got a lot going on there with the Federal Reserve Act, and obviously they're not paying any attention to it now. Will they in the future? Does that all get political? Do we have a big bailout? How do they get those bank reserves into legal tender, as Dr. Lacey Hunt would say? It's not just as straightforward as the Fed, quote unquote, printing money and buying stocks. Although I think that's definitely a possibility. So that's something I don't know that Mike touched on with Bill and Grant. And I want to bring that up with Mike. So that'll definitely be one of my questions. I don't want to put words in his mouth, and I really look forward to the interview. But my point is, I'm going to be asking him that question. And yeah, so I think the Fed could step in, but I'm sure Mike will have thought this through. So stay tuned for that interview. We've got good morning. I'm about to invest in biotechnologies. Would you support my theory? I don't know if I'd support it. It depends on the company. Is it cheap? I don't, if it's in biotech, I don't know. I don't normally like getting involved with stuff like that, but it doesn't mean that it's not right for you. I mean, it just might not be right for me. Generally, I like buying stuff that has intrinsic value or a lot of it and has a lot of cash coming in. And for whatever reason, you're just buying a dollar for 50 cents. Like gold at minus $40 a barrel. That's buying a dollar for 50 cents or buying a dollar for negative 40 cents. That I like doing stuff like that with biotech or some of these companies that have a lot of growth potential. I'm not saying they're not great investments. I'm just saying for me, that's not really my edge, because I feel like then I'm buying a dollar for $3 and hoping it goes to $5. And some people may be fantastic at that, but I just, for me personally, long-term, I don't think I'd come out ahead there. Okay, question, what type of RV ratios are you currently finding in Medellin? Can you rent these as long-term or short-term? What size is best to buy as an investment? How much can you expect to pay? So RV ratios, that is the way I define it, just monthly gross rent, compared to your cost basis. I think even Hartman defines a little bit different. He would say it's just your gross rent on the based on the value, or compared to the value of the property itself, regardless of what your cash basis is or cost basis. So as far as many, yeah, I mean, I can get 1% all day long. Can you rent these as long-term, short-term, both? With long-term though, I can get 1% or more. What size is best to buy as investment? Well, I mean, that's based on your individual skill set. What I like is right around, see, I'd have to think in meters. So I like 150. So that's around, I like about between 1,500 square feet and 2,000 square feet. That's my sweet spot. In meters, it would be like 150 square meters to maybe like 180 square meters. That would be the sweet spot. Although I've done less, I've done bigger. It's just that's kind of the where I really like to target, to hone in on. Why is that the best investment? I think it's the best because of liquidity, because you're just going to have a lot more buyers at that size and that type of price point. And if you've got a great location and you can turn it into an asset that's not a commodity, and that's the big challenge in Medellin, is you go there and you just buy any apartment that you see online or that that caters to like a gringo or something like that. And even if it's old, and then you do a quote unquote remodel, and you hire a local group to quote unquote remodel it. I keep doing that because 99 out of 100 remodels I see in Colombia or in Medellin, even if gringos do them, if I bought the property, I'd have to demo the whole thing and redo it all again because it's garbage. It looks terrible. It doesn't even look like a, it's horrible. And the thing that you have to remember, especially when you're investing in a market like Colombia or Medellin more specifically, when people are renting from you, if they're buying from you, they're looking for a lifestyle upgrade. They're not looking for a roof over their head. You've got to get that you've got to adjust mentally, because people think, oh, I'm just going to buy this and I'll just remodel it. And then since I have the word remodel on the ad, well, then people are going to pay me a premium price. No. People are buying that property based on the feeling that it gives them when they walk through the front door. It's emotional. It's strictly emotional. And so if the woman comes in and she sees this huge kitchen, she can just see herself entertaining with all of her friends, and it's got this quartz or Caesarstone or marble countertops, Carrera marble everywhere, and it just looks gorgeous. It looks something like you'd see in a magazine. And you go into the bedroom and it has this really kind of sexy modern type of glass shower there with rock, and it looks like this super high-end day spa in Vegas or somewhere in Singapore or someplace really fancy. You know, you feel like, wow, I'm not living just in an apartment or something with a roof over my head. This isn't just a living space. I feel like I'm rich. I feel like I've made it. I want to invite all my friends over and show this off. I want to take all these pictures and post it to my Facebook page because people are going to freak out about how amazing this place is that I just bought in Medellin. See, it's a lifestyle upgrade. So if you remodel an apartment and people come in and it's like, okay, well, I mean, it looks like the other 99 I've seen or the other 2,000 apartments I've seen in the last 2 weeks. And I mean, pretty much cookie cutter, exact same thing. I mean, I like the location. It's kind of nice, spacious, decent layout. All right, let's go look at the next one. What kind of price can I get on this? See, then your only negotiating factor, the only leverage you have as a seller or a renter or a landlord renting to someone is price. It's a commodity. It's just a barrel of oil. And the only way that you can sell your barrel of oil cheaper is just if you lower the price. I don't play that game. That's for someone else. So anyway, I'm ranting on here. But the point is that you want to make it a lifestyle upgrade. You want to trigger an emotional response. And as far as what size is best, that's perfect, from 1,500 to about 2,000 square feet, because that's the price point where most people can fit into. How much can you, but it all depends on location. You've got to have the right location. It's absolutely paramount. People will come to me and say, oh, you can never get $2,500 a month US in rent. Never. I'm in Envigado or I'm in Laurelis and I can't even get $500 a month for my apartment. Well, yeah, you're in Envigado. You're in Laurelis. I'm in Provenza. I'm two blocks from Parqueiras or from the Golden Mile. And my apartment is a lifestyle upgrade. It's not just a cookie cutter type of track home that you'd find in Las Vegas or the Medellin equivalent to that. So as far as how much you can expect to pay, it depends how good you are. If you're not very good and if you don't have a lot of experience, you're gonna overpay 9 times out of 10, unless you just get lucky somehow. If you're a local expert and you know what you're doing and you know how to negotiate, you're going to get it super, super cheap. I mean, as an example, the last apartment I bought there, we call it the Platinum apartment. I paid, maybe 115,000 US for it, and I'll sell it for maybe 350,000 US. I'll put maybe 50. I'll double my money easily. In fact, I could make probably a 30 or 40% return just by not doing anything to it, just putting it back on the market and just waiting. Why? Because I found a super, super motivated seller, and I know how to negotiate, and I know the market. I've been there for 5 years doing this nonstop. So it's all about local expertise. And if you can find a real estate market that is extremely inefficient, and most real estate markets are inefficient, and even in the United States, the real estate market is more inefficient than the gold market or the currency, bonds, stocks, but it's much more efficient than these others. But that can either be to your advantage or it can be to your disadvantage, just depending on how much experience you have. So anyway, moving on here. Oh, so STP in motion is a question, shorting the dollar by taking 30-year fixed rate debt or fixed rate mortgage. Do you see a risk getting screwed by the lenders in force majeure scenario where they could get your contract annulled? No. I don't see that happening. I think the Fed would buy the debt before that. You've got to remember that, if you were just, if 30-year fixed rate mortgages were just held by like a small percentage of the population, and it was a population that was, it was where the societal narrative is, it's okay to put a target on their back, such as quote unquote the rich, then you might have problems. But I mean, you're talking about rich people, poor people, middle class people. They all have, not all, but a good percentage of the population has a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. So politically, I don't think that would be palatable. When with these politicians, they have to just buy votes, and you can't pander to a group of people where there's only 100. But if you got a group of people where there's 100 million, then that's quite a bit different. So although that might be written into the contract, I think the probability of that playing out is incredibly low.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Oh yeah, E-Tech Electronic, or I'm sorry, E-Tech Electrical asks, is there any safe place to put wealth besides precious metals and crypto right now? For sure. I mean, commodities are super cheap. And we talk about it all the time on Rebel Capitalist Pro with Chris and Lynn. But and then Lynn actually has done a lot of research on areas outside of the United States where you can get some cheap stocks and cheap bonds as well. But look at a chart of commodities compared to financial assets going back to 1900. They're at all-time lows. So if you're someone that believes that we're going to have stagflation or that we're going to experience relatively high inflation over the next 10 years, then commodities is a great place to be right now. I don't know if you guys listened to my interview with Rick the other day, but if you haven't checked it, check it out. It was fantastic. And Rick is just such a great guy. He's straight shooter. Rick is just one of my favorites, not only on a professional level, but a personal level as well. And we outline a lot of the commodities. So I get his view on it, whether it's copper, uranium. And I know he's been bullish on uranium for quite a while, and he hasn't got the timing right. But I don't really worry about the timing too much. I just, if it's super cheap, I try to buy it and just hang on to it. And you're going to get some wrong and you're going to get some right. But I think if you do that over the long term, you're going to get more right than you get wrong. And I think that's pretty much the best we can do as just average investors. Or I shouldn't say average investors. I should say as just kind of people who don't dedicate our entire lives to doing this as a profession. Okay, Corey is asking, what are your thoughts on having some money in euro, yen, won, franc, pound, either as currency trusts on an exchange or the real thing? I know you're largely supporting holding dollars in rolling through treasury. Well, Corey, I think it really depends on what your expenses are denominated in. So if your expenses are denominated in euros, as an example, I don't know that I would have a lot of dollars. I might have some dollars, but I wouldn't have like 80% of my assets and or cash flow coming in from dollars if your expenses are euros. I think that's just a little too speculative for me. I mean, some people, I'm not saying it's right for everyone, but for me, that would be a little too much risk. As far as owning the currencies just as diversification, yeah. I mean, personally, Corey, I would try to own assets like real estate denominated in different currencies to have some diversification, and then have cash flow, just multiple streams of cash flow coming in different currencies. So then I could kind of hedge my bets that way. That's what I'd prefer. And then I see with my portfolio, I've got 10% in gold. So that's kind of my insurance against currency devaluation in with dry powder or anything like that, regardless of what currency you have it in. So it's a little hard for me to answer that question because that's a portfolio setup that's quite a bit different than the way I have mine, unless you're asking just about my cash position and dry powder, in which case, personally, I just do dollars. I've got some pesos too. I shouldn't say it. I've got some, but mostly dollars and just the T-bills. Yeah, I think that I would do that with whatever my expenses were denominated in. So the euro equivalent, the yen equivalent, the yuan, I don't know if they have a yuan equivalent of that, but the Swiss equivalent, the UK, etc. So Mark asks, we're 60 days away from the elections. What has history taught us for stock market volatility ahead of the election, how to play it? I mean, that's kind of a trading question, Mark. I don't know if I personally don't do that stuff. As far as just kind of a fun thought experiment, like a whiteboard video, I think you got to look at the TGA. And I think it would be tough to look at history because we've never in history had a TGA with even close to as much money as the Treasury General Account has right now. I mean, what is it, over $1.7 trillion? That is staggering. I talked to Lynn the other day, and she says that from Mnuchin has said they want to keep it at least 800 in there. But I mean, I think that's a moving target to say the least. And I think a lot of it's earmarked, but still they've got at least 500, 600 billion that they could pop into the real economy and therefore into the market, because you're not only creating broad money, but you're creating base money when you're doing that, or creating additional base and broad money. So that's just like a massive round of quantitative easing in addition to, you know, quote unquote stimulus. So who knows what type of volatility that can bring to the market. And I just spoke with Grant Williams on Friday. That video is going up tomorrow. And we talked about the TGA, and we talked about the two things that you've got to look for if you're trying to handicap future social unrest. And I'm not saying these are the only two things that you got to look for, but they're two main components. And I think that is rising asset prices and rising food prices. If we have asset prices and food prices going up at the same time, I think that's where you get more and more social unrest. So my point is with that TGA, if they're spending, $1 trillion into the economy, and we've got all these COVID lockdowns, and we've got supply constrictions on food, or, you know, we saw food prices skyrocket the last time that we went through this back in, what was it, April, May or so? If we go through another round of that, while at the same time, people are seeing the stock market go higher and higher and higher and higher every single day, and hearing all these stories about how Jeff Bezos made like $40 billion with a B on paper over the last 2 weeks, and Elon Musk made $20 billion in the last 3 days or whatever, just due to the stock prices going up, while at the same time, the average Joe and Jane that's watching that and seeing those headlines, they're going to the grocery store, and every single time they go to the grocery store, their bill goes up and up and up and up, and their paycheck goes down and down and down and down as far as their disposable income, if they have any at all. And they're like, what the F is going on here? This is BS. I'm not taking it anymore. And then they just get pissed. And like my old business partner says, it's never about what it's about. And I know I took a lot of heat for saying that on Chris's podcast the other day. I was on the QTR podcast, and I was talking about the riots or the social unrest or the looting. I said, I don't think it's about what it's about. I think it's the underlying issue of people just feeling as though they can't get ahead and that there's no hope. And if you take away a sense of hope as human beings, we do some pretty extreme things. And so my point is, I think if stocks and food is going up at the same time, that would equate to a feeling of more and more hopelessness or less hope in the eyes of the average person. So, and when you're looking at volatility, I mean, I think you're probably talking about market volatility, where I'm talking about both. I'm talking about stock market volatility, and I'm talking about social volatility. Like going long vol, I always talk about that. I think you can do that from a standpoint of your portfolio, but you can also do that from a standpoint of your physical presence. Like volatility to me is what we see in Portland or something like that, or XYZ city, it doesn't really matter, where you have these clashes of people, whether it's Antifa, the people on the right or whatever they're called. And it's just, always fighting. And when I was in Fort Lauderdale, the exact same thing. The people that were kind of wearing masks were fighting with the people that were wearing the full face masks, and they hated each other, and they're yelling at each other across the streets and giving people dirty looks at restaurants. And I'm like, what is this? This is insanity. And I think that just continues to, unfortunately, get worse. And Grant said it very well in our podcast. He says, listen, if you've got a big divide between left and right, that's not ideal, but it's not catastrophic. He's like, when you get a divide between another group, like rich and poor, that's when it normally hits the fan. So anyway, my point is if you're thinking about volatility in the market, I would also think about volatility at a social level as well. I know a lot of my buddies in Phoenix, I went to college in Phoenix. As most of you know, I almost flunked out of high school, but I actually did go to college barely. But anyway, a lot of my buddies are still down there, and most of them, I've just bought an RV, and I'm out. They didn't sell their house. They didn't do anything extreme. They just loaded up their families, their girlfriend, wife, kids, whatever, and loaded up their RV that they bought for 10 grand, used, something like that on Craigslist. And they just went up to the mountains. They just went up to Sholo or to Snowflake or Sedona, something like that, or Prescott. And they're like at a campsite. They got Wi-Fi. They're enjoying the outdoors. And they're just like, you know what? I'm up here for a couple months. I've got some flexibility. I can work on my computer. I'm good. I'm just going to chill out here for a while. In my opinion, that's going long volatility, just in a different way. Okay, so Mark is asking, I can take out 160K out of my primary residence at 2.9 fixed rate. After that, my loan will be 500 of a $1 million value. What do you recommend to do with the funds? Mark, that's a tough question, my friend. I can't tell you what to do with that, Mark. I just don't know your personal situation. The one advice I would give to you is I would say, if it were me, if I was extracting equity the way you are, and I would allocate the cash to an asset that paid me to own it, to make sure that I was getting cash flow to pay the mortgage and then some. So as an example, I love gold. I'm a big gold bug. I like 10%, as you guys know, but there is no way I would take out 160K from my primary or any residence in equity at that type of interest, or at any interest rate for that matter, and buy gold. There's no way, because gold doesn't pay me to own it, right? And I understand the upside, and understand it could go to 10,000 an ounce. I understand the bullish argument, and I am very bullish. I don't think there's a better bet long term than that. But I just would not personally do that unless what I was buying paid me enough, at least, to cover my mortgage payments. These next two questions are similar with Mark and Liberty Dog. Liberty Dog is asking, I think it's George, do you think it's a good idea to hold paper, gold, silver, and Roth IRA if you have one? I don't have one. I've never had an IRA. I've never had a 401k. I've never had any of that. Seems it would alleviate the cap gains tax on nominal gains issue you've talked about. Well, in a Roth IRA, maybe. Yeah, that might do it. I don't know. I don't want to give you any advice there, because I have no experience in that whatsoever. But that would make sense. And I can tell you that I would, if you're thinking about doing that, I would suggest looking at Rick's product, the PHYS, and that's his gold trust, Sprott's gold trust. And that's one that I've been investing in with my money, because you guys know I've been traveling so much with Medellin and St. Thomas and San Juan and Fort Lauderdale and all this nonsense with COVID. And now I'm in St. Bart's. It's not realistic for me to get physical delivery. So I'm just, in the interim, I'm personally just buying Rick's trust. And so when I interviewed Rick on Friday, that was my first question, in fact. And it was more of a kind of a selfish question, I guess, because I wanted to know, because I've been buying it. So I asked him about PHYS and how it differs from GLD and physical and all that stuff. So definitely check out that interview if that's something you're thinking about doing. But bottom line, I can't give you any advice because I don't have any experience there. But just right off the top of my head, yeah, it sounds like something that might work. So Mark, the same thing. I would defer to Rick in our interview. I don't have any specific mining stocks. That's tough, because most of them are not very good. And I haven't had time to do the research myself. I know that Lynn and Chris go into this quite extensively in Rebel Capitalist Pro with their research that we post there, but I have not done the homework. And I just, with everything that's been going on, I haven't had time. And that's not a good thing. I'm not doing it the right way. So do as I say, not as I do type thing, where I bought miners back in March, but I didn't have any time to do the research. So I just bought an ETF and I haven't sold it yet. I made a ton of money on it, but as far as a percentage. But as soon as I do get some time, then I'm going to start going through that and pick individual stocks, because I'd rather own the individual miners than just some ETF. Okay, let's see. The next question is about Rick's interview. and the company name that we mentioned in the Kohl's talk. I don't know. I don't recall a specific. I remember I spoke with Rick about coal. I was very interested to hear his opinion on that. I think he had a great opinion. It really made sense what he was talking about, which is basically make sure that if you're buying a coal company, that you're buying one that produces coal for steel instead of just energy. That was kind of his little quick tip there. But he goes into much more detail, so definitely check out the interview. I don't know that we talked about a specific ticker. So if we did, I don't recall which one. I apologize. What is the best way to invest in foreign currencies? That's a tough question, Jay, because I think it's based on the individual and where your area of expertise is. Like for me, since I'm a real estate guy, I would be, if I wanted to go long a currency, I would feel most comfortable doing it by going in and buying a rental property denominated in that currency. So one thing I was talking to Chris about the other day is Turkey. Because I'm sure you guys have followed the Turkish lira. I mean, that's just taking a pounding. And I think that you could get some cheap stuff there. And not that I want to go long the lira right now, but it is cheap. or at least it's, I don't know if cheap is the right word, because that would imply that it actually has some value. But I'm definitely not bullish the lira, let me say that. But if I did think it was undervalued for some reason, or it was cheap, and that it, I would express that by, and I know this isn't realistic for most people, but I'm just telling you what I would do. I would fly to Turkey, to Istanbul, or wherever I was interested in buying, and I would go for 2 weeks and just do what I always do. I think we talked about this last week on the live stream of Dubai, and that I'd go check out the malls, I'd hire a driver, I'd jog every morning, I'd talk to people. That's just kind of what I do and how I get a vibe for the area. And then I'd try to figure stuff out, and I wouldn't buy when I was there for the 2 weeks, but I'd figure out if I wanted to kick more tires and if it was something that was interesting long-term. And then maybe after 6 months or a year, maybe I buy something after I know what I'm doing and I'm a local expert, and then I've got that cash flow coming in. That's the way I personally would go long the currency. I know that's not right for most people. I totally get it. So for most people, I don't know. I just don't like any currencies. Yeah, I guess that's not your question. I don't know about an ETF, because I don't know how that's structured. And I mean, when you're buying, I don't know. I don't know if you're using futures there. I don't know how that works. I mean, I would probably just set up a bank account and just buy the cash. I'd probably just get the cash, Jay. I mean, you're going to have to pay a spread, but that's probably what I do. You want to know a secret, guys. And I don't know if you're, what I used to do to get the cheapest rate on currencies is I used to go to the casinos in Vegas. Because they're going to give you the lowest spread possible. They're going to give you a much lower spread than the bank. And why? Because they want to change in your euros for dollars, or dollars for euros, or yen, or blah, 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 blah. Because they think that you're going to spend it in the casino. So when I used to live in Vegas, I made a lot of money overseas. And every once in a while, we'd have a little bit of cash in a foreign currency. And I would just take that currency in, whether it was euros or South African rand or Singapore dollars, and I'd just take it down to the casino and exchange it. And I'd just pretend, like what I'd do is I'd buy chips. And then like 2 weeks later, I'd just take the chips and then I'd come and exchange them for dollars. And I'd get a I'd get a real cheap spread. But I realize that's not realistic for most people. So I would just buy the cash itself and store it. If you want to look at an ETF, that's great. But I would be careful about how they're tracking the currency itself.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity.
Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Connor is asking, I'm 40% gold stocks and miners. Should I be worried about deflationary? But you should be worried that you're 40% in gold stocks and miners, Connor. Yeah, and that's you do what's right for you. But I would not. I don't suggest that type of portfolio. That's you're just taking way too much risk. And I think that the major risk that most people don't understand is emotional risk. People, they always ask me, well, George, if you think that gold is going up, why don't you just buy all gold? Because you know, I'm a human being. That's why. And I'm flawed. And I'm, and although I like to think of myself as rational, at the end of the day, I'm not. I'm driven by emotions, like all of us are. Even the greats. We're all human beings and we're all hardwired a certain way. And that's never, ever, ever going to change. And so if you have 100% of your portfolio, you're just, it's going to drive you to make poor decisions. So most people, like if you had 40% of your assets in gold stocks and miners, what if it doubles, right? What do? Do you sell? Do you hold it? Do you buy more? Like, what do? Think about it. Most people never do. And I talked about this with Grant the other day, Grant Williams. People get hyper-focused. Like 99% of their thinking is this asset that I'm considering buying, is it going to go up or down in price? Quite frankly, although you should think about it, you should research it, you should do the homework, I think that should almost be your last priority. I think most of your bandwidth, your mental bandwidth, should be about portfolio management and portfolio construction, money management, risk management, and knowing when to buy and sell and having a game plan. And then you focus on, okay, what do I think is going to go up or what's cheap, what's expensive? I would never worry about what's going up or down in price. I think that's a fool's errand. So anyway, I'm going to just, again, I'm not saying that 40% is right or wrong. I'm saying for me, it would be wrong, but just kind of be careful and just remember how important portfolio management is to make sure that you're setting up your portfolio in a way that you can manage it with some degree of rationale and not 100% emotion. And I don't know how anyone could manage a portfolio with very little emotion if they had 100% of it or 40% of it all in one asset. So the question is, when was the last time in history it happened like everyone knew something ominous would come and came? I would read the fourth turning. I think that's going to give you some fantastic insight. Okay, Christopher, thank you for the super sticker, my friend. So Brandon's asking me, going back to that Rick Rule interview again about farmland, what are your thoughts on two agricultural REITs? I'd have to look at the underlying assets of the REITs themselves. I think it'd be worth looking at. I think it's interesting. I just don't, especially with real estate, I just prefer to manage my own portfolio, and I prefer to just buy it myself and have my people manage it instead of delegate that to someone that I didn't even know. But I think it'd be interesting. Definitely worth looking at. So Steven asks, do you think the politicians in DC understand how reliant the US economy is on continued stimulus? Or is there a lack of motivation to pass another stimulus because they think recovery is assured? Steven, I think you have a lot more faith in politicians than I do, my friend. I don't think they care at all. I mean, maybe one or two of them do. Politicians care about one thing, and that's themselves. And I think I was trying to kind of in my own mind yesterday distill down what's the difference between someone who would lean more towards big government and intervention and someone that's more free market and libertarian like myself. Like really, what's the difference there? And the more I gain in, I don't want to say popularity, because I think that's a little bit of a stretch talking about myself, but as I become more known, let's say on YouTube and social media and Twitter, you get a lot of people that I don't know if trolling is the right word or whatever. They just give you a hard time and stuff, and they're definitely coming. They're looking at things from a different slant, and they're I would call them in the socialist camp, maybe even in the Marxist camp. And so you say, okay, well, what's the difference? I mean, it's not, I don't like to say, oh, they're bad people, or I'm good, or I'm bad and they're good. I don't think it's as easy as that. It's much more nuanced. I think what it boils down to is, do you believe, or who do you believe is a better, who do you believe for society at large, is it better for individuals in the private sector? Is it better for individuals and entrepreneurs and private property holders to control the majority of the economy? Or is it better for individuals in government to control the majority of the private sector? And if you believe that it's better for individuals and entrepreneurs and private property holders in the economy to make their own decisions and to drive the economy, then I think you've got to favor free market. You do. You favor free market capitalism, and you most likely kind of that libertarian type of mindset. If you believe that the government is better at doing that because they're, for whatever reason, let's say politicians are somehow more benevolent, they're more wise, they're more ethical than these people in the private sector, then you're going to favor the Marxist socialist stuff. For me personally, I can't comprehend how anyone can see a politician as someone who is more virtuous than an entrepreneur. I think they're both following their own self-interest, but if you look at the net outcome by the entrepreneur following his or her self-interest, they're creating jobs. What's the politician doing, right? So anyway, my point is, in order to be a politician, what do you have to do? You have to be very good at lying. You have to be able you have to have no morals, no ethics. You have to be able to pander to any type of audience just to garner votes. Think about that for a moment, right? So you guys know my belief system very well by now. I'm sure you get it from watching these live streams or the Rebel Capitalist show or my whiteboard interviews. You get that I'm a free market guy. As an entrepreneur, I feel as though that's kind of the best path to prosperity, free market capitalism. Can you imagine what it would take for me to become a politician and have all these people, these advisors, let's say, come and say, George, you've got a shot at being a senator or whatever it is, but you've got to kind of tone down the free market stuff, and you've got to be in, we did these marketing polls, and if you actually come out in favor of a $15 minimum wage, you're going to get a lot more votes. and me saying, well, I'm really against a minimum wage altogether, but I mean, if I'm going to get more votes, then I'll come out here on national TV and I'll say that I'm in favor of a $15 minimum wage. Think about what type of person is required to be okay with that. And not only be okay with that, but to be proactive in making those decisions. In other words, going to their marketing people and say, okay, the next position or my next topic is minimum wage. What should be my stance there? Marketing people, should I be against minimum wage? Should I be for it? Should I be for a $15 minimum wage? What's going to get me the most votes? Marketing people, tell me. Okay, $15. Great, got it. I'll go. Press, I'm in favor of a $15 minimum wage. Think about that. You have to have no backbone, no spine, no ethical, no moral North Star, zero. You don't even have an ethical compass. It doesn't even exist. So you're sitting there, you're asking a question as though if they understand, I think in order to understand the effects of the stimulus on the economy, they would have to care about it in the first place. And I don't think they care. They don't care about the economy. They don't care about you. They don't care about me. They don't care about anything other than power and doing whatever they can and saying whatever they need to say to win votes and to get more power. That's what they're concerned with. So the takeaway there is I don't even think it's crossed their mind. So Richard is asking about condos. And when I was investing in the States, I liked single family much better. But now that I've done some stuff overseas, especially in Medellin, I actually like, I shouldn't say I like him just in general, because to your point, if the HOA is crazy, then that's going to be a nightmare you don't want to deal with. But there is some upside to condos in the sense that, like in Medellin, we just call them apartments. But your maintenance costs on apartments are going to be significantly lower than a single family home, unless you buy it like a new build. Because with the single family home, you're going to have plumbing leaks, you're going to have roof, foundation, landscaping, all of these things that can go wrong. And with an apartment, as an example in Medellin, it's concrete. There's no drywall. There's no 2x4s. It's all concrete. So if you have a renter that comes in there and gets pissed off and pow, like punches the wall or something, yeah, good luck with that. Try punching a concrete wall that's made of concrete and brick. That's not going anywhere. or if they have drywall, now you got to fix the drywall or whatever. So my point is that's the give and take. So you're going to have higher HOA fees, but you're going to have less in maintenance. So what I've seen in Medellin is it kind of is just a net wash. So what it boils down to is how big of a pain in the butt the HOA is. If they're pretty cool and they do a good job, then I wouldn't worry about it. If they're going to be a nightmare and just be like the like a Nazi HOA or whatever, you don't want to deal with that. What are my thoughts on Judy Shelton? I don't really have too many thoughts. I mean, I don't know that any of the Fed people know as much as I'd like them to know. I know she's more kind of in favor of gold, which is great. So I'd probably, I guess just based on that, I'd like her more than anyone else, but that's probably not saying a lot. And then Javier asks, what's the best place? Javier, you got to, any place in Medellin is going to be good for that, buddy. Rigo's asking where my Fed hat is. I'm going swimming after this. So I'm just going like this and not wearing a hat. I'm going to grab lunch and I got to do a live stream for Rebel Capitalist Pro. Then I'm going swimming. Okay, looks like we got a lot of real estate questions. I'm trying to mix up the questions, guys, but looks like the real estate is kind of winning the day today, so we'll go with that. So should I invest money in real estate to hedge my bet against inflation or wait for a potential crash? It's a very difficult question to answer because it depends on the seller. It depends on the price. That's what's great about real estate is it's very inefficient. So if you can find a motivated seller and get and buy a great RV ratio and a 2012 price, then yeah, take advantage of the interest rate. Why not? Makes sense. That said, would I go in and buy a condo in LA at a premium price right now? There's no way. No way. Not no chance. So it really depends. I don't want it to be a cop out answer, but I pretty much think that it depends on the market. It depends on the buyer. It depends on the seller, the RV, where the neighborhood. It just depends on so many things. I think at a macro level, the real estate market in the United States is in a bubble. I don't think that's even debatable if you look at the prices relative to 2006. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you can't find a good deal. So I know that's kind of, it sounds like I'm conflicting my opinion there, but it's just real estate is very inefficient. The next one is what financing available to first-time homeowner looking into an REO complex, live and rent system, 26-year-old, no debt. Well, that's, you're thinking about house hacking, Jerry, and so congratulations, first of all, because I think that's the best financial decision you can possibly make, assuming that you're positive cash flow with that investment. I don't know what type of financing is available because I don't get into that too much. I think Hartman would be a better guy to ask that question to. So if you just go to jasonhartman.com, and I don't know if his email address is there. If it is, just shoot him an email real quick. Or if one of his advisors, they would be much more equipped to answer that specific question on the financing that's available right now in the United States. Okay, so let's see. We'll wrap it up with this question. What about using the same amount? So Ryland is asking, would you recommend junior mining gold companies, big cap mining companies? I think they haven't quite caught up to the gold price increase yet, potential for big upward move. I don't know that I would probably buy, but I bought both as far as that ETF. I think, again, it's about portfolio management. I don't think it's about one or the other. It's about buying both, but then saying how much of my portfolio I want to allocate to X and then how much of my portfolio I want to allocate to Y. I think that's really the best advice I can give you. Okay, I think that's it. Well, Alex, actually, Ultimate Bargains is here. And I just saw you, buddy, and you're here every single week. And I really, really appreciate that. And I think I see you on Twitter, too, quite a bit. So let me go ahead and answer this question to the best of my ability. And I really appreciate you being here every week. What kinds of creative financing have you used to buy real estate? I don't know that I've used a lot of creative financing. I've used hard money and just to try it out, but I didn't really like it too much. But I've been a hard money lender down in Medellin, and that's worked really well because I was able to lend money against a peso denominated asset, but the loan is in dollars. So the person that I lent the money to is paying me back in dollars, and their balloon payment is in dollars. But it's against a really awesome, awesome apartment in Provenza. So I'm happy if I'm not happy, but if they default, I mean, it's no skin off my back at all. In fact, the way the contract's written, I actually would make more probably if there was a default by the borrower. Obviously, I don't want that, but you've got plenty of downside hedge is my point. And you're making it, I can't remember, I'm 10 or 12%. It's right around 10 or 12% that I'm making on that dollar loan. So good luck finding a 10 or 12% return in dollars that's backed by really great real estate where I don't have to do any work. I've seriously considered pooling a lot of my money together and just doing hard money loans in Medellin. But anyway, more to your question. One creative thing that I've done is when I first started getting in the real estate game, I really couldn't get a loan. I mean, it was wild. The best time for banks to loan against real estate, they'll never do it because it's when real estate's cheap and then they're all scared. So I was buying all my properties just in cash. And then I wasn't able to get very many loans on them other than the hard money. And what I was able to get after a while was a line of credit. So I got a line of credit against the equity I had in these homes. And at the time, it was a very low LTV just because of the environment for the real estate market. But then what I did with the line of credit is I went out and I took the line of credit and I used the money to buy a property in Medellin to renovate and sell. So let's just say it was 500. I took the 500 line of credit in the States and took the dollars, turned them into pesos, super cheap. And then I bought a really cheap property and I had my team remodel it. And then we sold it and I made maybe, I don't know, it was like 150 grand, something like that. And I made 150 grand on it. And then bam, I just paid the line of credit back, put the 150 grand in my pocket. And basically out of pocket, I had zero cost because I did the whole entire thing, the purchase and the remodel for with a line of credit. And so I used OPM. I used other people's money to do the deal in a whole separate country. So I don't know if that's kind of an example you're looking for, but that's an example that I've done today. And even now, I suggest if people are thinking about a refi to buy other real estate, I always tell them to do a line of credit first, because then you don't have to use the line of credit and you can just use it when you find a deal. You're not paying for it in the interim. And then when you do use the line of credit, then you can go back to the bank and you can say, hey, listen, I want to take this line of credit that I just used. Let's say you used 500 of it and I want to term it out. I want to turn it into a 30-year fixed rate loan. And they say, okay, well, we do that. Well, you know, blah, blah, blah. Most banks can do that. And if it's a smaller bank and they keep their portfolio loans, then they might not. But then you can just go to another lender that will pay off that line of credit with the new loan and then term it out 30 years fixed rate. So you see what I'm saying? So you start with the line of credit to give you some more flexibility. So, all right, guys, thank you very much for joining me today. I want to do some shout outs here for people that stayed all the way to the end. Arthur, there he is, Arthur Martinez. He's someone else that's always in the live streams, and I see him on the live streams of Rebel Capitalist Pro too. Arthur, I'll see you in about an hour here, buddy. But thanks for hanging out. Isaac, Brendan, CC, Jim, Gerald, Xavier, Engels, Iggy, Atlas, Mike, Richard, Juan, Emilio, it reminds me of, what was that? Night at the Roxbury. Remember that? That was a fantastic movie, wasn't it? All right. And guys, if you want to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro, remember Gene set up a promo where you get a week trial for $1. So check that out at georgegam.com/pro. And I will see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.